Despair is not a partial friend. He is not picky about your rank or station in life, who your friends are, or the success you've gained. This was especially true for a man called Horatio Spafford. Picture, a prominent Chicago lawyer with an expansive real estate portfolio around the city. He was a supporter, elder, and close friend of the famous preacher D.L. Moody. And at the age of 33, he married a Norwegian woman called Anna in 1861. They didn't reach their 10-year anniversary without despair forcing his friendship upon them. Their one and only son, his father's namesake, died of scarlet fever at the age of 4. The next year, in 1871, the Great Chicago Fire ravaged his entire prime real estate holdings along the shores of Lake Michigan. As one can only imagine, the stress took its toll on the family and on Horatio. 2 years after the fire, Horatio and Anna decided to take a sabbatical and holiday in England with their 4 daughters. Right before they were due to set sail, Horatio had some unexpected business come up that he had to attend to. Not wanting to delay their holiday for the family, he sent them on a French steamer from New York to Britain, promising to join them later. Back in Chicago, 9 days later, he received a telegram from Anna that read, "Saved alone." On November 2nd in 1873, the Ville de Havre had somehow collided with an English vessel and the boat sank in only 12 minutes, taking the lives of 226 people, including their 4 daughters. Anna's last memory had been of her baby girl being torn from her arms. Horatio boarded the next boat available to get him to his bereft wife to take the agonizing 10-day sail. Nearing the end of the passage, the captain called Horatio to the bridge and informed him that they were passing the location of the Ville de Havre. Swallowed up in grief, he then returned to his cabin and penned the words, "When peace like a river attendeth my way, when sorrows like sea billows roll, whatever my lot, thou hast taught me to say, it is well with my soul." You see, the prophet Jonah met a similar despairing fate, except his experience was self-inflicted. Thrown overboard into the Mediterranean, he was swallowed up by a fish. Jonah too turned to God. And while these two men in their darkest hour turned to God, their postures were vastly different, yet God still showed them both love. It makes me wonder whether our response to God in dark times is really in the right posture, or they were still holding back. Like Jonah, still thinking about ourselves, just looking for a quick way out. What can we learn from Jonah's time in the fish? Was the fish even real? That's this week on A Little Better. Our goal on this podcast is to know Jesus better and with the power of his spirit, do better. So together we can be a little better. Welcome back to the A Little Better podcast, where our whole goal is to help you mature in your faith. And before we get started, if you've been listening for a while, would you like and subscribe? It really helps communicate to us that this is a meaningful and helpful tool for you. And today we have Nate Miller. You're like half of my boss between you and Matt. Yeah. You're the Webster campus pastor. It's so great to have you back. This, you said as you walked in, this is the first time in the new set. So
I love what you've done with the place, Callum. It looks awesome. That's new setup, the colors. Yeah, it's beautiful.
I got to credit Taylor for that.
Good job, Taylor. Way to go. No one ever sees you, but you're the brains behind the operation. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we should get her on the podcast one time.
That'd be fun.
Pull her out. She's like shaking her head. No.
But we are going to be referencing a message that Nate preached this weekend, where we're talking about Jonah, the book of Jonah, in a series called Nineveh. So we'll have a link in the description. Hopefully you don't necessarily need to listen to the message to be able to follow along in this episode, but it'd be really helpful for you in your walk to go and listen to that message. So to start us off, Nate, I'd love to ask, have there been a time where you've actively resisted or disobeyed a call of God. Like you said, like God's been like, I want you to do this. Kind of similar to Jonah. That's kind of where I'm getting at. I'm not talking like sin rebellion. Like I know I'm actively sinning, but you know, this is the direction God wants me in. And you've kind of actively gone against it.
Yeah. I mean, the one that pops to my mind was like early on in our marriage. This wasn't really a sin issue, but it was more just like a direction and calling on our lives. Emily always had a calling and passion, you know, for college ministry. So a little bit of context, you know, we graduated from college, we got married. I had a teaching degree. Em had a teaching degree. We did that for 2 years.
Actually, not sure you had a teaching degree.
Yeah, in health and phys ed. Okay. So, you know, those who can't teach, teach gym, right? That's the famous quote.
Those who failed, got B's yeah. and C's, that would be me.
So yeah, I was a teacher. So I coached soccer. And so that was my first job out of college. And I was teaching, we were down in Pennsylvania together, and M just continually felt this nudge to do college ministry, to go into like full-time like missions work. And I kind of pushed back and resisted that. Like, are you really, really sure? Questioned that. But over, yeah, just a period of time, it just really became clear that I needed to listen to Em and be sensitive to what God was saying, not just to her, but even to us and to our family. And that kind of really was a big part of what ushered us into full-time ministry. And so I often look back at one of those times where she was just very like initially sensitive and like, this is where we need to go. And I was not on board with it as quickly as she was. And it definitely took some time for me to come around to it. So, that's the first one.
There's some resistance there on your part.
Yeah. Of just like, are you sure? Questions like, how are we going to make it work? We got to 100% raise our financial support. Do we really want to do that? Do you really want to be, you know, having to be in that position of always wondering? And we had great, reliable jobs where we were at, and we were newly married. So there was a lot of more just, I think, the uncertainty and the fear of the unknown that was holding me back, where Em has such great, strong faith. Like when she feels like there's something God is directing or guiding her, like she's just so like, yeah, I'll go. Where I feel like, I don't know, at least for me, it takes me a little bit longer than it does for her. So there's those questions, fear and things like that I had to work through to get to the place where I was like, all right, I'm ready to go.
Have you found that muscle of embracing, I mean, it's the whole adage, like faith over fear, like that kind of a thing. Have you found that muscle of faith and being able to embrace things quicker? Have you seen that muscle grow in you at all?
I think so. I think I've also just been more aware, like if M is sensing something too, like to listen to that. And like that is even a way of God has helped me to exercise that muscle is through seeing it in M. I think as I have gotten older, I think that faith muscle has been growing, you know, especially as you have kids. Like there's so much that's outside of your control that we need to continually just ask God for his help and step out in faith versus just trying to live in this control mindset of everything has to be in its right spot. But I don't know. It's probably not where it needs to be, but I feel like it's an area of growth for sure over time.
Cool. Well, we're hitting on Jonah chapter 2, and you kind of really, it's the last a couple of sentences of chapter 1 right, where we see Jonah is, well, I'll ask you, frame the story just now.
Yeah.
Like where's, so we kind of give it, catches up to speed in Jonah's story up to the end of chapter 2.
Yes. So chapter 1 is all about Jonah running from God. That was week 1. And Drew walked us through that of the, you know, the call that Jonah had to go to Nineveh to reach these people who were pagan enemies of Israel, to say, hey, God's judgment is coming, but look, God's grace and mercy is also available to you. He rebels against that. He heads as far away from Nineveh as he possibly could at that time, on a boat. And he's out on the Mediterranean Sea. Storm comes up. Sailors freak out. What's going on? They realize it's Jonah. They try to figure out, what do we need to do to get the waves and the wind to stop? Jonah tells him, throw me overboard. And so they reluctantly do that. And so I pick up the story and that moment where Jonah is just descending into darkness, into the sea. realizing that his running, his rebellion, his choices have led him to this moment where he is sinking. And so that's then when the fish shows up, which is what the story of Jonah is often known about. We're like, oh yeah, that's that one where this guy and this fish, and this God provides this fish as an act of his mercy to save Jonah's life when Jonah was completely unable to save himself. And so then we looked at his prayer. So Jonah prays this prayer from the belly of the fish. And we kind of just walked through that of like how in his distress, God heard him, met him with mercy, how he begins to seemingly understand like rebelling against God isn't the right way. Salvation comes from the Lord. Don't pursue like the idols of idolatry of other nations or other people, but to pursue God. And then the fish vomits him up, we believe, back at Joppa. We're not really sure, but it seems to indicate that that might be where he gets a second chance now of like, okay, what are you going to do now? God rescued you. He's giving you another chance to fulfill the call that he had placed on Jonah's life. So that's it in a nutshell, pretty much. Yeah.
Every year we go back to, or we try and go back to Scotland, and my parents have a house on the island of Islay. And which takes a 2.5-hour ferry ride from Kennacraig to Port Ellen or Port Askeig. Now, I've been in some pretty rocky seas. Never once has any of us turned to each other and be like, who on board needs to get thrown off? Yeah. The reason why the wind is picking up, there's a storm happening, is because someone's sin. I find it really interesting. I mean, maybe it's a, I don't know if you have any thoughts on this. Is it a cultural thing that they're ascribing all this meaning to? Where I mentioned last week with Drew is that at the time, which probably meant the Ninevites were softened to the message that God was trying to say to them, was because there was a famine and a solar eclipse. Now there's a, how the circumstances and nature going around it, we don't tend to ascribe some of those spiritual meanings to it. Do you think that was part of their idolatry? Do you think that was part of the way God was working in that culture? I'm curious if you've got any thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. It's hard to know with certainty, especially, I mean, we look at it now through the lens of history and we can see what was happening and what was at play, but to attribute the cause to that, I don't know that with certainty I can pinpoint that to whether that is a reality of the people's sin or the culture of that day, or is this just simply God trying to once again show his mercy and wake Jonah up? And also through that, redeem pagan sailors like Drew talked about last week. Obviously, we know God is sovereign. He's in control of all of that and can work through all of that. But I don't know. That's a good question. I'm not 100% sure.
In some ways, it doesn't really matter. It's a contextual question sure. that I'm curious about. But really, we're talking about three things this week. So Jonah's descent, his distress, and deliverance. And I want to hit Jonah's descent first. Talk us through this sort of downward spiral a little bit more of Jonah.
Yeah, it really is interesting. As I was reading and studying chapter one and listening to Drew last week, it was really interesting just to see and notice all the choices and decisions that Jonah had been making up until chapter two were down. Mm-hmm. You know, even just you see that language within chapter one of down to Joppa, then he goes down into the fish, then he goes down into the sea, down into the belly. And so that just really struck me again, like when we rebel against God or when I push back against God and what we know is true and right, it's always going to take me down and away from his blessing, his goodness, his peace, his presence. And not only just in my walk with him, but also my relationships are going to suffer and not be what they ought to be and how or what God desires for them to be. And so, yeah, you just see this pattern of just rebellion, pattern of going against what God wants. Even, you know, I talked about like it can be interesting to look at Jonah deciding like, hey, just throw me overboard. Like that can almost feel like a noble or sacrificial thing. But again, that was just another bad decision where he should have just said, take me back and I need to obey what God is calling me to do. But even still, nope, I'd rather die than obey. And so, yeah, we just see this pattern all throughout chapter one of him just, God says this, I'm going to do the exact opposite.
Yeah, I find that a really interesting point in the story of he doesn't say, I'll jump overboard.
Mm.
He says to the sailors, no, you throw me overboard.
Yeah.
And I don't, you give us a little bit of a frame of mind where you think Jonah's at. Like, is he suicidal? Is he just flat out rebellious and hard-hearted? Like, where do you think he's at?
For sure. I definitely think he's hard-hearted, and I definitely think he values, he would rather die than obey God. I think it could be, you know, in his deceitfulness and in sin of like, you know, maybe he doesn't quite have enough courage to do it himself. And so maybe he feels a little bit more justified if like, hey, you do it, you know, or that's the way, you know, so it's a subtle deception in his mind to be able to put this maybe more on the sailors. Cause you even see it in the sailors, right? In chapter one, they're like, God, please don't hold us accountable essentially for this man's life. And so, he was definitely running from God, definitely no desire to want to obey or follow. And so that's certainly clearly evident in the way he's reacting in this moment.
We have to address the elephant
the whale.
The fish in the room.
Right.
Was it a real fish or are we talking about symbolism?
Yeah. It's a great question. A lot of that comes down to whether or not you believe that this story of Jonah is just a parable or a fable or just like a story that was used to convey a point. And so a lot of that comes down to your interpretation of just your general overview of Jonah. I know you and Drew talked about it last week. We believe that it is true. And so I believe that it is a real fish. And I believe that, you know, so then the next question is, okay, well then how is that even physically possible? Like, can someone even survive in the belly of a fish for, you know, for 3 days? And
I looked it up and it said no.
I saw that too, between the acid and everything that's going on there would not be enough oxygen present. So, I would attribute it to just, it's a miracle. It's a miracle, just like the many other miracles that God provided, that he allowed this fish to be his provision of mercy over Jonah. And I would say it's more just a miracle. Some people were trying to say, well, maybe there was an air pocket in there and like it was just enough, so.
That's gotta be nice, clean air
that
he's breathing in there.
Right.
What was interesting as I got from listening to your message is how the fish was a provision. Now we don't know. I'm guilty of saying it's a whale. We don't know because a whale is like the biggest amphibian that we know.
Sure.
But the fish was provision. So you get thrown into the sea. We have no idea if the dude can swim. Probably not. I'm not sure if there was a Y in Israel, like a YMCA or something in our lifetime that they're getting lessons, but he's on his way to his death and God ordains this fish to swallow him up as a way of preserving him. It was actual provision from God, which I'd never taken before from this story, which I found really interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure he wished it was like the Coast Guard or the Navy SEALs or like a cushy, like, you know, boat or whatever, but he provides, just this nasty, I can't imagine. Again, I'm not a big seafood guy, but rolling around in the stomach of a fish had not to be pleasant. Mm-hmm. Must not have been a pleasant situation, but I mean, because the text even says the Lord provided a fish. So God was the one who provided this way out for Jonah, and the way out was through riding around in the belly of a fish for 3 days. But it wasn't punishment, it was provision.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
3 days and three nights. You make this parallel, and I find it really to Jesus. You make this parallel to Jesus. It's almost this motif that we see where Jesus references the sign will be of Jonah that I can't remember in Matthew. Oh, here, a wicked and adulterous generation asks for a sign, but none will be given and accept the sign of the prophet Jonah. This is the Pharisees were looking for a sign. That's Matthew 12:39. And then in Matthew 12:41, a little after, the men of Nineveh will stand up in the judgment with this generation and condemn it, for they repented and the preaching at the preaching of Jonah, so the Ninevites, that's later on in the story of Jonah, for they repented at the preaching of Jonah, and now something greater than Jonah is here. Mm. So this motif that Jesus greater than Jonah, I just find it so interesting that Jesus would refer to this rebellious, hard-hearted prophet, that that's the one he would choose to model, not right. model himself, but would be the one to reference.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, it's fascinating. It really is interesting. I mean, you got 3 days, 3 nights showing up in Jonah. Obviously, we know the story of Jesus and how he was, you know, in the grave for, you know, 3 days, 3 nights. It's, it is fascinating that that's the example. Like, there couldn't be any other shining example or illustration that Jesus would point back to as a sign. But I mean, it is, it's remarkable. And it really is a beautiful foreshadowing of what Jesus would do for us through Jonah's life. And I think that's why, I think that that's what hit me as I was looking through this message and what do we focus on, of just like, we have to be able to place ourselves in this story and not just view it from this lens of historical events that did happen and take place, but to really see, like, this is a picture of us and what Christ has done for us. The story of Jonah is this foreshadowing of Christ's death, burial, and resurrection. But it is, and that also to me is one of the greatest evidence why it was a true story, is the fact that Jesus mentioned it, called back to it. But it is interesting that that, you know, was the story Jesus called back to show as a sign of his deity to the Pharisees who are questioning whether or not he was God or not.
There's so many questions I have for Jesus when I eventually meet him in wrestling through his humanity and deity at the same time, because you oftentimes, and we've just, we've come through this series on suffering called Through the Fire. We've talked about the kind of purpose in it, and you see Jesus, we don't know if he knows he's going to die or not, but here he's referencing, it sounds like he does know he's going to a place that's unsurvivable or supposed to be unsurvivable. So you would think that, okay, I'm going to endure the cross. This is going to be awful, but it's going to be temporary. That's kind of what we tell ourselves when we go through something hard. It's only for a short period of time. And then I know there's going to be something better on the other side, but yet we still see him sweating blood. We still see him going through the anguish of it all, which in some ways to me is comfort in knowing, just because we react and find it hard doesn't mean that because there's light at the end of the tunnel, it makes it easier.
Right, sure.
You mentioned that we kind of see ourselves, this is kind of moving past that, but we kind of see ourselves as Jonah. But I'm wondering if the parallel example with Jesus, would it not make sense that we are Nineveh? Not Jonah. Because oftentimes we kind of put ourselves as the disciples. We insert, almost personify ourselves in different characters in the Bible.
Sure.
If that's the parallel, would we actually not be Nineveh? Or is it okay to then somewhat see ourselves as Jonah? What are the pros and cons of that?
I guess for sure we can see ourselves, I would say, in both, like Nineveh, right? A wicked, rebellious people, no desire to follow God in any way, shape, or form. I think, you know, the Assyrians, I mean, even still to this day, they are some of the wickedest people that, and some of the things that they did, like on record, that that we still talk about and are aware of what they did. And so, like, that wickedness that they demonstrated is certainly something we can relate to just as a result of our own sin that we have, like that. We are all wicked before a holy, perfect, and righteous God. And so certainly we can place ourselves there as a rebellious people, just like the Ninevites. And then, yeah, I definitely think we can also see ourselves in Jonah as well when we look at the choices and decisions that he makes to rebel against God's best for his life. You know, certainly we can see moments in our lives where we emulate that, that we do that, that we think we know what's best. We think we know what freedom looks like or what satisfaction looks like, but yet it always leads, just like Jonah, away from God and are in desperate need of his mercy. And so, I mean, I feel like we can see, we can paint a picture or understand us in both.
Yeah.
Both. Yeah.
There's a rupturing in the relationship between Jonah and God. And I think this is something that can come or should come for us, whether we place ourselves, quote unquote, as Jonah, or whether we can just learn from the character of God and the beauty, mercy, grace of God, the love of God, and how he rescues. Because Jonah parted God in anger. He like left. I'm going away from what you've called me to do. Then the rupture of relation. So the rupture of relationship started with Jonah, but it was God that was pursued the reconciliation. It was provision of the fish. It wasn't that Jonah did anything to deserve the fish. If anything, he didn't. But that doesn't mean that the provision for us isn't kind of grimy and nasty.
Yeah.
Back to him. But it's almost like God, yes, there's provision, but there's still something that God wanted to teach Jonah, which I want to get to in his distress. But I saw Spurgeon commented on this. Jonah's blank forgiveness that he does not appear to have, though upon his God, all the while the storm raged, the billows rolled and the ship was tossed with tempest. Let me say that again, because I don't think it was pretty clear. Jonah's blank forgetfulness that he does not appear to have, upon his God, all the while the storm raged, there's no, when all this situation is happening, he's not remembering God. So the storm's raging, he doesn't think of God. He doesn't, he's in the water, doesn't think of God. What it appears to be is that he's in the belly of a fish for 3 days and three nights and doesn't recognize God. It took him 3 days to then get to the point of prayer.
Right. Potentially. I mean, he does say at the beginning of his prayer in verse one, in my distress, you heard me. So now, was that distress as he was falling, or was that distress when he's in the belly of the fish? So that's one piece I have a question about.
It's a little unclear, the timing. But it seems though that it's like God heard him
right,
and spat him out. Again, it's hard to know. Is that immediate? Yeah. Is it not?
Right.
But Jonah's distress, and we get to the prayer. It seems like God needed to get Jonah to a place of distress to have him turn to him, right? Mm-hmm. What can we learn from this? What are the implications of when it comes to that God will put us in a distressful situation or put us in distress to get our attention?
Yeah, I think, again, what you might view as distress in an awful situation, there might be a provision in there. There might be a way in which God is trying to say, this is, and he knows, like, this is the one way or the one avenue that he'll use to get a hold of your attention. And maybe there have been other ways, more subtle ways or different ways, but I think we can look at any and all situations and see and know and trust that there is a provision of blessing there, a provision of mercy there that is for us to see God extending out a way out. And so, sometimes that comes through really hard seasons or even messy situations, but I feel like that's though where the hope comes from. No matter what anyone's situation is, there is always a way out. And as you think about a person or in your own life or someone you think that's too far gone or we've tried too many times or I've prayed for so long, like, you just never know. There, God's mercy is always ready and present for those who are willing to cry out to him in repentance, as we see from, you know, Jonah 2. So I hope that brings encouragement to people even in the midst of really hard seasons and difficult, like, things to piece together how this could be the way. I don't know, but yeah, we can trust and know that God's at work in it.
Yeah, as we talked about it in the series Through the Fire, that it's there for our maturation, but what we didn't really hit on was it can actually be the way out to the way out of way back to God may actually be through the fire.
That's right. Yeah.
Don't mean to make that a pun, but that's like, it's the way out, and that we didn't really hit on that, which I think is important. So we get to this prayer and we can learn from it. There's no place in the Mediterranean Sea in a whale, fish. We don't necessarily know.
We don't know. Yeah.
But God can still hear us, and that should be a great encouragement. I'm curious from your overall perspective as you kind of studied Jonah 2, what's your overall perception of the prayer and Jonah's heart behind it?
If I didn't have chapters 3 and 4, it probably would lead me to think like he got it. Mm. But because I know the end of the story, and I'm not trying to give away too much, keep watching. It's hard because he says things there in his prayer that are great, that are really good, of like people have turned away from God's love. Okay, that's cool. Then he must know something about God's love. He's shouting to God with shouts of praise and like worship, it seems like. Mm-hmm. He's saying good things like turn away from idols. Like, yes, he's amen.
Quoting Psalms.
Yeah. Like there's only one person who saves. It's God. Like, so it's a really interesting prayer in and of itself. I'm like, man, there's a lot of really, really, really good things there, but it's hard to know in this moment. Is it just he's praising God because circumstantially God preserved his life and he's not dead? So is this just a circumstantial, you made my life better, versus a, no, my identity, like who I am, like my life has changed and I am fully dependent on you, Lord, and you are. And so then that will show up in the way that he now thinks about the people of Nineveh. And I think it's tough. It's hard. Mm-hmm. Again, if I didn't know the end of the chapter or the end of the book, mm-hmm. I don't know.
I find it really interesting because there's a point in it, it's like, you cast me out, which kind of shows Jonah's disassociation, that he doesn't like the sailors, or he's disassociating himself from responsibility. He's doing the things like quoting the Psalms, like you said. And then he referenced those who pay regard to vain idols forsake their hope of steadfast love, referring to the sailors who actually experienced God's love
right.
on the ship.
Right.
And he's just, the nuance of it is almost like he's praying around the prayer that he ought to pray. He's saying all the right things. And it says later, it's like, I will sacrifice to you, but it's almost like I won't, which to me, I read into that of like, I will sacrifice for, or sacrifice to you. The Jewish system of like sacrificing animals is as a way of atonement, rather than I will sacrifice myself for you. Mm-hmm. Again, perhaps I'm over reading into that or not, but it seems like he's saying all the right things and his posture isn't quite there. Though it sounds like his posture is there.
Right.
And God still delivers him.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of irks me because that means that, like, we can do the right thing, we can say the right thing, but our heart inside of us is still not there yet. God still shows his mercy.
Right.
So there's something about posture there. That
sure. Yeah. I mean, it really, that is an interesting thought. I mean, to have on that, I think again, to me, it just shows again, just the patient, loving God that he is, to even if he is beating around the bush and still not fully getting it, God is still patient and kind and willing to rescue him and extend, you know, his mercy, which again, to me, I think provides a lot of hope of like, it's not too late. Again, like he continues to offer these opportunities to Jonah and certainly to us today, but that is an interesting thought though.
We're not trying to get ahead in the story too much.
Yeah.
And in some way he turns to God, and we're going to find out next week that he does go to Nineveh. Do you think that his perspective changed, but his heart didn't? Or do you think there was actual heart change? Do you think he was just kind of begrudgingly right. at this point?
It's hard to know. Again, if you look at the rest of the story, there definitely seems to be some level of a willingness to go. What's the motivation for that? How do you splice that between just God circumstantially providing for him versus him realizing, you know, that God is everything and that he's going to fully, wholeheartedly worship him with his life? And it's really hard. It's really hard to say. And I don't want to give away too much. That way you guys can keep percolating and looking into what happens. So I don't know. Is it a blend of it, but I don't know.
Is there something to take from it though, that it doesn't mean that everything needs to be in place?
Sure. Yeah.
But it's the returning to God, the turning back to him that.
Mm-hmm. And that could be part of that. Maybe that was like a moment for Jonah. And then God continued later in his life to show faithfulness and mercy and teach him and shape and form him. Mm-hmm. But I do think, right, it is a process. And there are different moments, I think, that God uses to refine and shape and mold us and mold our faith.
The picture that comes to mind is like the mustard seed, faith of a mustard seed, something so small. And I mentioned earlier of like it feels like he's praying around a prayer that I think he knows he should pray, but he's not ready to pray it yet. Mm. Like, you know, God, I want to give you my everything I have. You send me to the ends of the earth. You do what you want with me. Is like, are you really ready to say that prayer?
Sure.
And I think it's one of the kind of disservices when we make salvation accessible to the point where it's not taking that into consideration. Mm-hmm. Now, if you knew that your whole life would turn upside down, would you do it in the first place? Mm-hmm. But it's like he's dancing around what he really should be saying, but God still honors the little that he gives him. And I think that should be an encouragement to us that despite that, God can still answer, he's still here, he's still gracious
us. That's right.
But then we get to Jonah's, we call it deliverance, but as I was doing some reading on it, it was like the term vomited was quite, it could just be very like literal. Like, my dad was a doctor and the terms he uses, like, just is quite the medical terms. It's like just on the nose. Yeah. And he uses a bunch of medical terms that you're like, I don't even know what that means. What does that mean in English? But it's vomited. Could have just been spat. The whale got rid of Jonah. There's so many other words, but the writer, it says vomited. And I wonder if you find any meaning in that, of like I see like an expression of disgust. Mm-hmm. Like, God ordained a fish to swallow him and then commanded him to like get rid of the bile.
Right.
And it's not clean by any means.
Right, you know? Right. I think it's hard to know, again, with certainty exactly how to read all of that in, but it could certainly be just, again, God is showing mercy to him, but yet also is showing the frustration as well.
Yeah.
Like, and there's both that play there of his frustration of just like, again, I've provided, but yet like, dude, like, you know, so I think there's both at play there of like God's love and care and mercy for Jonah, but yet also just being maybe frustrated at, again, like, dude, this guy is so hard-hearted. Like, when is he fully going to like truly like show the rightful worship and gratitude for all that God has done?
We're not good at holding paradox, but I think scripture's full of paradox where you're saying like, he's not ready yet, but God is willing to do something with the not yet.
Yeah.
And I think so much of the times when we talk in church of like, you don't need to get yourself clean. You don't need to find yourself in the perfect spot for God to use you. Because Jonah clearly isn't. He's not this squeaky clean prophet that we kind of have in our mind, but actually he's still at work and God still sends him in that vomited state, perhaps still covered in the stench, still going. And for us, I think understanding that we don't have to be the best version of ourselves, the cleanest version of ourselves for God to work. That's There's still such grace in that.
Yeah.
Some believe that he was, I think you mentioned this earlier. Some believe he was vomited back to Joppa. Mm-hmm. Explain that a little bit more. Where do you see that? Unpack that. Is it just a symbol of redemption?
I think it could be a couple of things. Like, it took, you know, a more literal one is like, well, he was sailing to Tarshish. That's 2,500 miles away. So it took a whale about three days to get all the way back.
Do we know where he was vomited out, or where he got swallowed in the fish?
No, we just know he was on his way. We don't know where that is. So some might attribute it to that. We don't know for sure. Again, it's scholars kind of think that as, again, this second chance. Here's another opportunity to put him right back at the place where God initially called him, but he rebelled in disobedience to say, okay, hey, here's your second chance to obey what God has called him to do. So that's why I think people assume that. But again, we don't know with certainty where the fish vomited him back up, but a lot of people tend to agree that it seems to make sense that it would have been back at Joppa where he was originally called. But we don't fully know.
What should we take from Jonah's story up until this point? What are the takeaways? What's the action points? What is the things we should hold on to from this up to this point in the story?
Yeah, I mean, to me, I think the thing that kind of wrecked me was like just seeing myself in Jonah. Like, this isn't just a prophet and an Israelite who's sinking down and away from everything, you know, in the sea, but like that's me, that's my life, that's my sin, that reality of the length that God would go to rescue us by sending his son Jesus, and the extension of mercy that is for us when we rightfully deserve separation, we rightfully deserved to not be with God because of our sin, but yet he sent his son for us, and he died in our place, purchased us. That would just awaken a sense of hope in us, a sense of gratitude, shake our souls free and awake again, to not just like see the story of Jonah and this guy who messed up, but to also see us as the person that has walked away from God and has rebelled against God, but yeah, he extends his mercy to us. And so at this point, it would just be the awareness of God's mercy and the extent at which he is willing to go to share that with us while we don't deserve it, that would just stir in us a gratitude and a response of gratefulness, humility, that would move us forward to want to follow him more. Yeah.
I think about someone listening that might be in that state of distress that they are in their equivalent of the either sinking in the Mediterranean or in the belly of a fish. Mm. What would you say to them? How do you encourage them? What should they hear from this story? What can they take from Jonah, and what's their perspective? I'd love for you to talk to that person.
I would just say that God sees you. He knows where you are at. He knows what you're thinking, what you're feeling. He cares about every detail of your life and the situation or circumstance that you might be in or are facing. And to know that he is there and his mercy is there and he is ready and a willing, loving father to extend that mercy to anyone who turns to him, who cries out to him for help. And so you are not too far gone. You have not dug yourself into a place that is too far away from God's mercy. He is a loving, gracious, good God that wants to provide mercy to us. And like we talked about, sometimes it takes us going through the mud or the hard moments for us to see that, but he's ready and he's willing. And so don't wait. You can cry out to him, and he's not, like we've talked about, he's not going to hold that against you. There's not condemnation or like, why did it take you so long? Or how could you, or why did you do that? You're going to be met, and you'll find that mercy and forgiveness that he's so willing to extend.
I want to be conscious too, because I can almost hear the person being like, but it doesn't feel any better, you saying that. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember where I heard it recently, but there's only so much rationalizing that can do for us, or the truth to hear, that God still needs us to experience it. God still needs us to discover, which requires us to go through the emotion of it all so that we can actually understand the truth that being told. And so I'm conscious that we can say things like that and it can feel like
just the Band-Aid or
it's just like, it could be for some, well, that's the churchy answer. Of course, that's what it is. And they might already know it, and it's not actually balm for the soul, balm for the soul. But actually you're there because God wants you to discover it.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And you don't discover it unless you're actually in it.
Right.
And so it doesn't seem like Jonah discovered it until he, by God's grace, got to that point, and his mercy of preserving him in an extremely dark, supposed to be uninhabitable place. And that feeling of like, I don't know how I'm supposed to survive this. It's there for a reason. Mm-hmm. And just because I'm saying it's there for a reason doesn't mean to make it easier for that person. But embrace the fact that where you're at right now is so that you can discover God.
Yeah, there's something there.
There's something there. I'm also conscious of the person who, I think in as we grow in maturity of Jesus, our heart becomes more like him. The more and we're in relationship with God, the more our old self, we take off the old self, is taken away from us, and the new self, we take on Jesus, and we're like, oh, yeah, I'm not really rebelling. Like, I'm not really disobeying him or anything like that. And I want to caution us from being away from being calloused.
Yeah.
And if anything, to take a discovery, if possible, away from this of God's still so merciful. Mm. And he wants to communicate a message of love to us. And that ultimately is the message that Jonah is tasked to take to the Ninevites and our role to take to those around us. So I say this every week, but we become a little better when we love God and love others a little better. And so hopefully through this series, as we're talking about Jonah, you can take that. You can take that love. You can embrace that love and make a difference in this world as we are here to spread and magnify, multiply the kingdom throughout. In a really simple way, this is a total, like, feels so icky saying this, but I know a simple way of doing that is by liking and subscribing. Like and smash that like
button. Yeah.
But it can actually, it helps other people hear some of this content, and especially an even better way is if you have a friend or something that's in that distressful place, maybe just share the episode with them. And that might be helpful to them. So we've got 2 more weeks left of this series called Nineveh, and hopefully you can continue with us as we continue this conversation. See you next week.